consisted of a single pregnant young woman carrying a male fetus. But believers in the fluke colonization theory have been surprised by recent discoveries that still other islands, lying to the east of New Guinea, were colonized soon after New Guinea itself, by around 35,000 years ago. Those islands were New Britain and New Ireland, in the Bismarck Archipelago, and Buka, in the Solomon Archipelago. Buka lies out of sight of the closest island to the west, and could have been reached only by crossing a water gap of about 100 miles. Thus, early Australians and New Guineans were probably capable of intentionally traveling over water to visible islands, and were using watercraft sufficiently often that the colonization of even invisible distant islands was repeatedly achieved unintentionally. The settlement of Australia-New Guinea was perhaps associated with still another big first, besides humans' first use of watercraft and first range extension since reaching Eurasia, the first mass extermination of large animal species by humans. Today, we regard Africa as the continent of big mammals. Modern Eurasia also has many species of big mammals, though not in the manifest abundance of Africa's Serengeti plains, such as Asia's rhinos and elephants and tigers, and Europe's moose and bears, and until classical times, lions. Australia-New Guinea today has no equally large mammals, in fact no mammal larger than 100-pound kangaroos. But Australia-New Guinea formerly had its own suite of diverse big mammals, including giant kangaroos, rhino-like marsupials called diprotodonts and reaching the size of a cow, and a marsupial leopard. It also formerly had a 400-pound ostrich-like flightless bird, plus some impressively big reptiles, including a one-ton lizard, a giant python, and land-dwelling crocodiles. All of those Australian-New Guinean giants, the so-called megafauna, disappeared after the arrival of humans. While there has been controversy about the exact timing of their demise, several Australian archaeological sites with dates extending over tens of thousands of years and with prodigiously abundant deposits of animal bones have been carefully excavated and found to contain not a trace of the now extinct giants over the last 35,000 years. Hence, the megafauna probably became extinct soon after humans reached Australia. The near simultaneous disappearance of so many large species raises an obvious question. What caused it? An obvious possible answer is that they were killed off or else eliminated indirectly by the first arriving humans. Recall that Australian-New Guinean animals had evolved for millions of years in the absence of human hunters. We know that Galapagos and Antarctic birds and mammals, which similarly evolved in the absence of humans and did not see humans until modern times, are still incurably tame today. They would have been exterminated if conservationists had not imposed protective measures quickly. On other recently discovered islands where protective measures did not go into effect quickly, exterminations did indeed result. One such victim, the dodo of Mauritius, has become virtually a symbol for extinction. We also know now that on every one of the well-studied oceanic islands colonized in the prehistoric era, human colonization led to an extinction spasm whose victims included the moas of New Zealand, the giant lemurs of Madagascar, and the big flightless geese of Hawaii. Just as modern humans walked up to unafraid dodos and island seals and killed them, prehistoric humans presumably walked up to unafraid moas and giant lemurs and killed them too. Hence, one hypothesis for the demise of Australia's and New Guinea's giants is that they met the same fate around 40,000 years ago. In contrast, most big mammals of Africa and Eurasia survived into modern times, because they had co-evolved with proto-humans for hundreds of thousands or millions of years. They thereby enjoyed ample time to evolve a fear of humans as our ancestors' initially poor hunting skills slowly improved. The dodo, moas, and perhaps the giants of Australia and New Guinea had the misfortune suddenly to be confronted, without any evolutionary preparation, by invading modern humans possessing fully developed hunting skills. However, the overkill hypothesis, as it is termed, has not gone unchallenged for Australia-New Guinea. Critics emphasize that as yet no one has documented the bones of an extinct Australian-New Guinean giant with compelling evidence of its having been killed by humans, or even of its having lived in association with humans. Defenders of the overkill hypothesis reply, you would hardly expect to find kill sites if the extermination was completed very quickly and long ago, such as within a few millennia some 40,000 years ago. The critics respond with a counter-theory. Perhaps the giants succumbed instead to a change in climate, such as a severe drought on the already chronically dry Australian continent. The debate goes on. Personally, I can't fathom why Australia's giants should have survived innumerable droughts in their tens of millions of years of Australian history, and then have chosen to drop dead almost simultaneously, at least on a timescale of millions of years, precisely and just coincidentally when the first humans arrived. The giants became extinct not only in dry central Australia, but also in drenching wet New Guinea and southeastern Australia. They became extinct in every habitat without exception, from deserts to cold rainforest and tropical rainforest. Hence, it seems to me most likely that the giants were indeed exterminated by humans, both directly by being killed for food, and indirectly as the result of fires and habitat modification caused by humans. But regardless of whether the overkill hypothesis or the climate hypothesis proves correct, the disappearance of all of the big animals of Australia and New Guinea had, as we shall see, heavy consequences for subsequent human history. Those extinctions eliminated all the large wild animals that might otherwise have been candidates for domestication, and left native Australians and New Guineans with not a single native domestic animal. Thus, the colonization of Australia and New Guinea was not achieved until around the time of the Great Leap Forward. Another extension of human range that soon followed was the one into the coldest parts of Eurasia. While Neanderthals lived in glacial times and were adapted to the cold, they penetrated no farther north than northern Germany and Kiev. That's not surprising, since Neanderthals apparently lacked needles, sewn clothing, warm houses, and other technology essential to survival in the coldest climates. Anatomically modern peoples who did possess such technology had expanded into Siberia by around 20,000 years ago. There are the usual much older disputed claims. That expansion may have been responsible for the extinction of Eurasia's woolly mammoth and woolly rhinoceros. With the settlement of Australia and New Guinea, humans now occupied 3 of the 5 habitable continents. Throughout this book, I count Eurasia as a single continent, and I omit Antarctica because it was not reached by humans until the 19th century and has never had any self-supporting human population. That left only 2 continents, North America and South America. They were surely the last ones settled, for the obvious reason that reaching the Americas from the Old World required either boats, for which there is no evidence even in Indonesia until 40,000 years ago, and none in Europe until much later, in order to cross by sea, or else it required the occupation of Siberia, unoccupied until about 20,000 years ago, in order to cross the Bering Land Bridge. However, it is uncertain when, between about 14,000 and 35,000 years ago, the Americas were first colonized. The oldest unquestioned human remains in the Americas are at sites in Alaska dated around 12,000 BC, followed by a profusion of sites in the United States south of the Canadian border and in Mexico in the centuries just before 11,000 BC. The latter sites are called Clovis sites, named after the type site near the town of Clovis, New Mexico, where their characteristic large stone spear points were first recognized. Hundreds of Clovis sites are now known, blanketing all 48 of the lower U.S. states south into Mexico. Unquestioned evidence of human presence appears soon thereafter in Amazonia and in Patagonia. These facts suggest the interpretation that Clovis sites document the Americas' first colonization by people who quickly multiplied, expanded, and filled the 2 continents. One might at first be surprised that Clovis descendants could reach Patagonia, lying 8,000 miles south of the U.S.-Canada border, in less than 1,000 years. However, that translates into an average expansion of only 8 miles per year, a trivial feat for a hunter-gatherer, likely to cover that distance even within a single day's normal foraging. One might also at first be surprised that the Americas evidently filled up with humans so quickly that people were motivated to keep spreading south toward Patagonia. That population growth also proves unsurprising when one stops to consider the actual numbers. If the Americas eventually came to hold hunter-gatherers at an average population density of somewhat under one person per square mile, a high value for modern hunter-gatherers, then the whole area of the Americas would eventually have held about 10 million hunter-gatherers. But even if the initial colonists had consisted of only 100 people, and their numbers had increased at a rate of only 1.1% per year, the colonists' descendants would have reached that population ceiling of 10 million people within 1,000 years. A population growth rate of 1.1% per year is again trivial. Rates as high as 3.4% per year have been observed in modern times when people colonized virgin lands, such as when the HMS Bounty mutineers and their Tahitian wives colonized Pitcairn Island. The profusion of Clovis Hunter sites within the first few centuries after their arrival resembles the site profusion documented archaeologically for the more recent discovery of New Zealand by ancestral Maori. A profusion of earlier sites is also documented for the much older colonization of Europe by anatomically modern humans, and for the occupation of Australia and New Guinea. That is, everything about the Clovis phenomenon and its spread through the Americas corresponds to findings for other unquestioned virgin land colonizations in history. What might be the significance of Clovis sites bursting forth in the centuries just before 11,000 BC, rather than in those before 16,000 or 21,000 BC? Recall that Siberia has always been cold, and that a continuous ice sheet stretched as an impassable barrier across the whole width of Canada during much of the Pleistocene ice ages. We have already seen that the technology required for coping with extreme cold did not emerge until after anatomically modern humans invaded Europe around 40,000 years ago, and that people did not colonize Siberia until 20,000 years later. Eventually, those early Siberians crossed to Alaska, either by sea across the Bering Strait, only 50 miles wide even today, or else on foot at glacial times when Bering Strait was dry land. The Bering Land Bridge, during its millennia of intermittent existence, would have been up to 1,000 miles wide, covered by open tundra, and easily traversable by people adapted to cold conditions. The land bridge was flooded and became a strait again, most recently when sea level rose after around 14,000 BC, Whether those early Siberians walked or paddled to Alaska, the earliest secure evidence of human presence in Alaska dates from around 12,000 BC. Soon thereafter, a north-south ice-free corridor opened in the Canadian ice sheet, permitting the first Alaskans to pass through and come out into the Great Plains around the site of the modern Canadian city of Edmonton. That removed the last serious barrier between Alaska and Patagonia for modern humans. The Edmonton pioneers would have found the Great Plains teeming with game. They would have thrived, increased in numbers, and gradually spread south to occupy the whole hemisphere. One other feature of the Clovis phenomenon fits our expectations for the first human presence south of the Canadian ice sheet. Like Australia and New Guinea, the Americas had originally been full of big mammals. About 15,000 years ago, the American West looked much as Africa's Serengeti Plains do today, with herds of elephants and horses pursued by lions and cheetahs, and joined by members of such exotic species as camels and giant ground sloths. Just as in Australia and New Guinea, in the Americas, most of those large mammals became extinct. Whereas the extinctions took place probably before 30,000 years ago in Australia, they occurred around 17,000 to 12,000 years ago in the Americas. For those extinct American mammals whose bones are available in greatest abundance and have been dated especially accurately, one can pinpoint the extinctions as having occurred around 11,000 BC. Perhaps the two most accurately dated extinctions are those of the Shasta ground sloth and Harrington's mountain goat in the Grand Canyon area. Both of those populations disappeared within a century or two of 11,100 BC. Whether coincidentally or not, that date is identical, within experimental error, to to the date of Clovis Hunter's arrival in the Grand Canyon area. The discovery of numerous skeletons of mammoths with Clovis spear points between their ribs suggests that this agreement of dates is not a coincidence. Hunters expanding southward through the Americas, encountering big animals that had never seen humans before, may have found those American animals easy to kill, and may have exterminated them. A counter theory is that America's big mammals instead became extinct because of climate changes at the end of the last ice age, which, to confuse the interpretation for modern paleontologists, also happened around 11,000 BC. Personally, I have the same problem with a climatic theory of megafaunal extinction in the Americas as with such a theory in Australia and New Guinea. The America's big animals had already survived the ends of 22 previous ice ages. Why did most of them pick the 23rd to expire in concert, in the presence of all those supposedly harmless humans? Why did they disappear in all habitats, not only in habitats that contracted, but also in ones that greatly expanded at the end of the last ice age? Hence, I suspect that Clovis hunters did it, but the debate remains unresolved. Whichever theory proves correct, most large wild mammal species that might otherwise have later been domesticated by Native Americans were thereby removed. Also unresolved is the question whether Clovis hunters really were the first Americans. As always happens whenever anyone claims the first anything, claims of discoveries of pre-Clovis human sites in the Americas are constantly being advanced. Every year, a few of those new claims really do appear convincing and exciting when initially announced. Then the inevitable problems of interpretation arise. Were the reported tools at the site really tools made by humans, or just natural rock shapes? Are the reported radiocarbon dates really correct, and not invalidated by any of the numerous difficulties that can plague radiocarbon dating? If the dates are correct, are they really associated with human products, rather than just being a 15,000-year-old lump of charcoal lying next to a stone tool actually made 9,000 years ago? To illustrate these problems, consider the following typical example of an oft-quoted pre-Clovis claim. At a Brazilian rock shelter named Pedro Ferrada, archaeologists found cave paintings undoubtedly made by humans. They also discovered, among the piles of stones at the base of a cliff, some stones whose shapes suggested the possibility of their being crude tools. In addition, they came upon supposed hearths, whose burnt charcoal yielded radiocarbon dates of around 35,000 years ago. Articles on Pedro Ferrada were accepted for publication in the prestigious and highly selective international scientific journal Nature. But none of those rocks at the base of the cliff is an obviously human-made tool, as are Clovis points and Cro-Magnon tools. If hundreds of thousands of rocks fall from a high cliff over the course of tens of thousands of years, many of them will become chipped and broken when they hit the rocks below, and some will come to resemble crude tools chipped and broken by humans. In Western Europe and elsewhere in Amazonia, archaeologists have radiocarbon dated the actual pigments used in cave paintings. But that was not done at Pedro Ferrada. Forest fires occur frequently in the vicinity, and produce charcoal that is regularly swept into caves by wind and streams. No evidence links the 35,000-year-old charcoal to the undoubted cave paintings at Pedro Ferrada. Although the original excavators remain convinced, a team of archaeologists who were not involved in the excavation but receptive to pre-Clovis claims recently visited the site and came away unconvinced. The North American site that currently enjoys the strongest credentials as a possible pre-Clovis site is Meadowcroft Rock Shelter in Pennsylvania, yielding reported human-associated radiocarbon dates of about 16,000 years ago. At Meadowcroft, no archaeologist denies that many human artifacts do occur in many carefully excavated layers. But the oldest radiocarbon dates don't make sense, because the plant and animal species associated with them are species living in Pennsylvania in recent times of mild climates, rather than species expected for the glacial times of 16,000 years ago. Hence, one has to suspect that the charcoal samples dated from the oldest human occupation levels consist of post-Clovis charcoal infiltrated with older carbon. The strongest pre-Clovis candidate in South America is the Monteverde site in southern Chile, dated to at least 15,000 years ago. It, too, now seems convincing to many archaeologists, but caution is warranted in view of all the previous disillusionments. If there really were pre-Clovis people in the Americas, why is it still so hard to prove that they existed? Archaeologists have excavated hundreds of American sites unequivocally dating to between 2000 and 11,000 BC, including dozens of Clovis sites in the North American West, rock shelters in the Appalachians, and sites in coastal California. Below all the archaeological layers with undoubted human presence, at many of those same sites, deeper, older layers have been excavated and still yield undoubted remains of animals, but with no further evidence of humans. The weaknesses in pre-Clovis evidence in the Americas contrast with the strength of the evidence in Europe, where hundreds of sites attest to the presence of modern humans long before Clovis hunters appeared in the Americas around 11,000 BC. Even more striking is the evidence from Australia and New Guinea, where there are barely one-tenth as many archaeologists as in the United States alone, but where those few archaeologists have nevertheless discovered over 100 unequivocal pre-Clovis sites scattered over the whole continent. Early humans certainly didn't fly by helicopter from Alaska to Meadowcroft and Monteverde, skipping all the landscape in between. Advocates of pre-Clovis settlements suggest that, for thousands or even tens of thousands of years, pre-Clovis humans remained at low population densities or poorly visible archaeologically for unknown reasons unprecedented elsewhere in the world. I find that suggestion infinitely more implausible than the suggestion that Monteverde and Meadowcroft will eventually be reinterpreted, as have other claimed pre-Clovis sites. My feeling is that if there really had been pre-Clovis settlement in the Americas, it would have become obvious at many locations by now, and we would not still be arguing. However, archaeologists remain divided on these questions. The consequences for our understanding of later American prehistory remain the same, whichever interpretation proves correct. Either the Americas were first settled around 11,000 BC and quickly filled up with people, or else the first settlement occurred somewhat earlier, most advocates of pre-Clovis settlement would suggest by 15,000 or 20,000 years ago, possibly 30,000 years ago, and few would seriously claim earlier. But those pre-Clovis settlers remained few in numbers, or inconspicuous, or had little impact, until around 11,000 BC. In either case, of the five habitable continents, North America and South America are the ones with the shortest human prehistories. With the occupation of the Americas, most habitable areas of the continents and continental islands, plus oceanic islands from Indonesia to east of New Guinea, supported humans. The settlement of the world's remaining islands was not completed until modern times. Mediterranean islands, such as Crete, Cyprus, Corsica, and Sardinia, between about 8500 and 4000 BC. Caribbean islands, beginning around 4000 BC, Polynesian and Micronesian islands between 1200 BC and AD 1000, Madagascar sometime between AD 300 and 800, and Iceland in the 9th century AD. Native Americans, possibly ancestral to the modern Inuit, spread throughout the high Arctic around 2000 BC. That left as the sole uninhabited areas awaiting European explorers over the last 700 years, only the most remote islands of the Atlantic and Indian Oceans, such as the Azores and Seychelles, plus Antarctica. What significance, if any, do the continent's differing dates of settlement have for subsequent history? Suppose that a time machine could have transported an archaeologist back in time for a world tour at around 11,000 BC. Given the state of the world then, could the archaeologist have predicted the sequence in which human societies on the various continents would develop guns, germs, and steel, and thus predicted the state of the world today? Our archaeologist might have considered the possible advantages of a head start. If that counted for anything, then Africa enjoyed an enormous advantage. At least 5 million more years of separate proto-human existence than on any other continent. In addition, if it is true that modern humans arose in Africa around 100,000 years ago and spread to other continents, that would have wiped out any advantages accumulated elsewhere in the meantime and given Africans a new head start. Furthermore, Human genetic diversity is highest in Africa. Perhaps more diverse humans would collectively produce more diverse inventions. But our archaeologist might then reflect, what really does a head start mean for the purposes of this book? We cannot take the metaphor of a foot race literally. If by head start you mean the time required to populate a continent after the arrival of the first few pioneering colonists, that time is relatively brief, for example, less than 1,000 years to fill up even the whole new world. If by head start you instead mean the time required to adapt to local conditions, I grant that some extreme environments did take time, for instance, 9,000 years to occupy the high Arctic after the occupation of the rest of North America. But people would have explored and adapted to most other areas quickly, once modern human inventiveness had developed. For example, after the ancestors of the Maori reached New Zealand, it apparently took them barely a century to discover all worthwhile stone sources, only a few more centuries to kill every last moa in some of the world's most rugged terrain, and only a few centuries to differentiate into a range of diverse societies, from that of coastal hunter-gatherers to that of farmers practicing new types of food storage. Our archaeologists might therefore look at the Americas and conclude that Africans, despite their apparently enormous head start, would have been overtaken by the earliest Americans within at most a millennium. Thereafter, the Americas' greater area, 50% greater than Africa's, and a much greater environmental diversity, would have given the advantage to Native Americans over Africans. The archaeologists might then turn to Eurasia and reason as follows. Eurasia is the world's largest continent. It has been occupied for longer than any other continent except Africa. Africa's long occupation before the colonization of Eurasia a million years ago might have counted for nothing anyway, because proto-humans were at such a primitive stage then. Our archaeologists might look at the upper Paleolithic flowering of southwestern Europe between 20,000 and 12,000 years ago, with all those famous artworks and complex tools, and wonder whether Eurasia was already getting a head start then, at least locally. Finally, the archaeologist would turn to Australia-New Guinea, noting first its small area, it's the smallest continent, the largest fraction of it covered by desert capable of supporting few humans, the continent's isolation, and its later occupation than that of Africa and Eurasia. All that might lead the archaeologist to predict slow development in Australia-New Guinea. But remember that Australians and New Guineans had by far the earliest watercraft in the world. They were creating cave paintings, apparently at least as early as the Cro-Magnons in Europe. Jonathan Kingdon and Tim Flannery have noted that the colonization of Australia and New Guinea from the islands of the Asian continental shelf required humans to learn to deal with the new environments they encountered on the islands of central Indonesia, a maze of coastlines offering the richest marine resources, coral reefs, and mangroves in the world. As the colonists crossed the straits separating each Indonesian island from the next one to the east, they adapted anew, filled up that next island, and went on to colonize the next island again. It was a hitherto unprecedented golden age of successive human population explosions. Perhaps those cycles of colonization, adaptation, and population explosion were what selected for the Great Leap Forward, which then diffused back westward to Eurasia and Africa. If this scenario is correct, then Australia and New Guinea gained a massive head start that might have continued to propel human development there long after the Great Leap Forward. Thus, an observer transported back in time to 11,000 BC could not have predicted on which continent human societies would develop most quickly, but could have made a strong case for any of the continents. With hindsight, of course, we know that Eurasia was the one, but it turns out that the actual reasons behind the more rapid development of Eurasian societies were not at all the straightforward ones that our imaginary archaeologist of 11,000 BC guessed. The remainder of this book consists of a quest to discover those real reasons. Chapter 2. A Natural Experiment of History. On the Chatham Islands, 500 miles east of New Zealand, centuries of independence came to a brutal end for the Moriori people in December 1835. On November 19th of that year, a ship carrying 500 Maori armed with guns, clubs, and axes arrived, followed on December 5th by a shipload of 400 more Maori. Groups of Maori began to walk through Moriori settlements, announcing that the Moriori were now their slaves, and killing those who objected. An organized resistance by the Moriori could still then have defeated the Maori, who were outnumbered 2-1. However, the Moriori had a tradition of resolving disputes peacefully. They decided in a council meeting not to fight back, but to offer peace, friendship, and a division of resources. Before the Moriori could deliver that offer, the Maori attacked en masse. Over the course of the next few days, they killed hundreds of Moriori, cooked and ate many of the bodies, and enslaved all the others, killing most of them, too, over the next few years, as it suited their whim. A Moriori survivor recalled, "The Maori commenced to kill us like sheep. We were terrified, fled to the bush, concealed ourselves in holes underground and in any place to escape our enemies. It was of no avail. We were discovered and killed, men, women, and children, indiscriminately." A Maori conqueror explained, "We took possession in accordance with our customs, and we caught all the people. Not one escaped. Some ran away from us, these we killed, and others we killed. But what of that? It was in accordance with our custom." The brutal outcome of this collision between the Moriori and the Maori could have easily been predicted. The Moriori were a small, isolated population of hunter-gatherers equipped with only the simplest technology and weapons, entirely inexperienced at war, and lacking strong leadership or organization. The Maori invaders from New Zealand's North Island came from a dense population of farmers chronically engaged in ferocious wars, equipped with more advanced technology and weapons, and operating under strong leadership. Of course, when the two groups finally came into contact, it was the Maori who slaughtered the Moriori, not vice versa. The tragedy of the Moriori resembles many other such tragedies in both the modern and the ancient world, pitting numerous well-equipped people against few ill-equipped opponents. What makes the Maori-Moriori collision grimly illuminating is that both groups had diverged from a common origin less than a millennium earlier. Both were Polynesian peoples. The modern Maori are descendants of Polynesian farmers who colonized New Zealand around AD 1000. Soon thereafter, a group of those Maori, in turn, colonized the Chatham Islands and became the Moriori. In the centuries after the two groups separated, they evolved in opposite directions, the North Island Maori developing more complex and the Moriori less complex technology and political organization. The Moriori reverted to being hunter-gatherers, while the North Island Maori turned to more intensive farming. Those opposite evolutionary courses sealed the outcome of their eventual collision. If we could understand the reasons for the disparate developments of those two island societies, we might have a model for understanding the broader question of differing developments on the continents. Moriori and Maori history constitutes a brief, small-scale natural experiment that tests how environments affect human societies. Before you read a whole book examining environmental effects on a very large scale, effects on human societies around the world for the last 13,000 years, you might reasonably want assurance from smaller tests that such effects really are significant. If you were a laboratory scientist studying rats, you might perform such a test by taking one rat colony, distributing groups of those ancestral rats among many cages with differing environments, and coming back many rat generations later to see what had happened. Of course, such purposeful experiments cannot be carried out on human societies. Instead, scientists must look for natural experiments in which something similar befell humans in the past. Such an experiment unfolded during the settlement of Polynesia. Scattered over the Pacific Ocean, beyond New Guinea and Melanesia, are thousands of islands differing greatly in area, isolation, elevation, climate, productivity, and geological and biological resources. For most of human history, those islands lay far beyond the reach of watercraft. Around 1200 BC, a group of farming, fishing, seafaring people from the Bismarck Archipelago, north of New Guinea, finally succeeded in reaching some of those islands. Over the following centuries, their descendants colonized virtually every habitable scrap of land in the Pacific. The process was mostly complete by AD 500, with the last few islands settled around or soon after AD 1000. Thus, within a modest time span, enormously diverse island environments were settled by colonists, all of whom stemmed from the same founding population. The ultimate ancestors of all modern Polynesian populations shared essentially the same culture, language, technology, and set of domesticated plants and animals. Hence, Polynesian history constitutes a natural experiment, allowing us to study human adaptation devoid of the usual complications of multiple waves of disparate colonists that often frustrates our attempts to understand adaptation elsewhere in the world. Within that medium-sized test, the fate of the Moriori forms a smaller test. It is easy to trace how the differing environments of the Chatham Islands and of New Zealand molded the Moriori and the Maori differently. While those ancestral Maori who first colonized the Chathams may have been farmers, Maori tropical crops could not grow in the Chathams' cold climate, and the colonists had no alternative except to revert to being hunter-gatherers. Since as hunter-gatherers they did not produce crop surpluses available for redistribution or storage, they could not support and feed non-hunting craft specialists, armies, bureaucrats, and chiefs. Their prey were seals, shellfish, nesting seabirds, and fish that could be captured by hand or with clubs and required no more elaborate technology. In addition, the Chathams are relatively small and remote islands, capable of supporting a total population of only about 2,000 hunter-gatherers. With no other accessible islands to colonize, the Moriori had to remain in the Chathams and to learn how to get along with each other. They did so by renouncing war, and they reduced potential conflicts from overpopulation by castrating some male infants. The result was a small, unwarlike population, with simple technology and weapons, and without strong leadership or organization. In contrast, the northern, warmer part of New Zealand, by far the largest island group in Polynesia, was suitable for Polynesian agriculture. Those Maori who remained in New Zealand increased in numbers until there were more than 100,000 of them. They developed locally dense populations, chronically engaged in ferocious wars with neighboring populations. With the crop surpluses that they could grow and store, they fed craft specialists, chiefs, and part-time soldiers. They needed and developed varied tools for growing their crops, fighting, and making art. They erected elaborate ceremonial buildings and prodigious numbers of forts. Thus, Moriori and Maori societies developed from the same ancestral society, but along very different lines. The resulting two societies lost awareness even of each other's existence, and did not come into contact again for many centuries, for perhaps as long as 500 years. Finally, an Australian seal hunting ship visiting the Chathams en route to New Zealand brought the news to New Zealand of islands where there is an abundance of sea and shellfish. The lakes swarm with eels, and it is a land of the karaka berry. The inhabitants are very numerous, but they do not understand how to fight and have no weapons. That news was enough to induce 900 Maori to sail to the Chathams. The outcome clearly illustrates how environments can affect economy, technology, political organization, and fighting skills within a short time. As I already mentioned, the Maori-Moriori collision represents a small test within a medium-sized test. What can we learn from all of Polynesia about environmental influences on human societies? What differences among societies on different Polynesian islands need to be explained? Polynesia as a whole presented a much wider range of environmental conditions than did just New Zealand and the Chathams, although the latter define one extreme, the simple end of Polynesian organization. In their subsistence modes, Polynesians ranged from the hunter-gatherers of the Chathams through slash-and-burn farmers to practitioners of intensive food production living at some of the highest population densities of any human societies. Polynesian food producers variously intensified production of pigs, dogs, and chickens. They organized workforces to construct large irrigation systems for agriculture and to enclose large ponds for fish production. The economic basis of Polynesian societies consisted of more or less self-sufficient households, but some islands also supported guilds of hereditary part-time craft specialists. In social organization, Polynesian societies ran the gamut, from fairly egalitarian village societies to some of the most stratified societies in the world, with many hierarchically ranged lineages and with chief and commoner classes whose members married within their own class. In political organization, Polynesian islands ranged from landscapes divided into independent tribal or village units up to multi-island proto-empires that devoted standing military establishments to invasions of other islands and wars of conquest. Finally, Polynesian material culture varied from the production of no more than personal utensils to the construction of monumental stone architecture. How can all that variation be explained? Contributing to these differences among Polynesian societies were at least six sets of environmental variables among Polynesian islands: island climate, geological type, marine resources, area, terrain fragmentations, and isolation. Let's examine the ranges of these factors before considering their specific consequences for Polynesian societies. The climate in Polynesia varies from warm tropical or subtropical on most islands, which lie near the equator, to temperate on most of New Zealand, and cold subantarctic on the Chathams and the southern part of New Zealand's South Island. Hawaii's Big Island, though lying well within the Tropic of Cancer, has mountains high enough to support alpine habitats and receive occasional snowfalls. Rainfall varies from the highest recorded on Earth in New Zealand's Fiordland and Hawaii's Alakai Swamp on Kauai to only one-tenth as much on islands so dry that they are marginal for agriculture. Island geological types include coral atolls, raised limestone, volcanic islands, pieces of continents, and mixtures of those types. At one extreme, innumerable islets, such as those of the Tuamotu Archipelago, are flat, low atolls barely rising above sea level. Other former atolls, such as Henderson and Rennell, have been lifted far above sea level to constitute raised limestone islands. Both of those atoll types present problems to human settlers, because they consist entirely of limestone without other stones, have only very thin soil, and lack permanent fresh water. At the opposite extreme, the largest Polynesian island, New Zealand, is an old, geologically diverse continental fragment of Gondwana land, offering a range of mineral resources, including commercially exploitable iron, coal, gold, and jade. Most other large Polynesian islands are volcanoes that rose from the sea, have never formed part of a continent, and may or may not include areas of raised limestone. While lacking New Zealand's geological richness, the oceanic volcanic islands at least are an improvement over atolls from the Polynesian's perspective, in that they offer diverse types of volcanic stones, some of which are highly suitable for making stone tools. The volcanic islands differ among themselves. The elevations of the higher ones generate rain in the mountains, so the islands are heavily weathered and have deep soils and permanent streams. That is true, for instance, of the Societies, Samoa, the Marquesas, and especially Hawaii, the Polynesian archipelago with the highest mountains. Among the lower islands, Tonga, and to a lesser extent, Easter, also have rich soil because of volcanic ash falls, but they lack Hawaii's large streams. As for marine resources, most Polynesian islands are surrounded by shallow water and reefs, and many also encompass lagoons. Those environments teem with fish and shellfish. However, the rocky coasts of Easter, Pitcairn, and the Marquesas, and the steeply dropping ocean bottom and absence of coral reefs around those islands are much less productive of seafood. Area is another obvious variable, ranging from the 100 acres of Anuta, the smallest permanently inhabited isolated Polynesian island, up to the 103,000 square miles of the mini-continent of New Zealand. The habitable terrain of some islands, notably the Marquesas, is fragmented into steep-walled valleys by ridges, while other islands, such as Tonga and Easter, consist of gently rolling terrain presenting no obstacles to travel and communication. The last environmental variable to consider is isolation. Easter Island and the Chathams are small and so remote from other islands that once they were initially colonized, the societies thus founded developed in total isolation from the rest of the world. New Zealand, Hawaii, and the Marquesas also are very remote, but at least the latter two apparently did have some further contact with other archipelagos after the first colonization, and all three consist of many islands close enough to each other for regular contact between islands of the same archipelago. Most other Polynesian islands were in more or less regular contact with other islands. In particular, the Tongan archipelago lies close enough to the Fijian, Samoan, and Wallace archipelagos to have permitted regular voyaging between archipelagos, and eventually to permit Tongans to undertake the conquest of Fiji. After that brief look at Polynesia's varying environments, let's now see how that variation influenced Polynesian societies. Subsistence is a convenient facet of society with which to start, since it in turn affected other facets. Polynesian subsistence depended on varying mixes of fishing, gathering wild plants and marine shellfish and crustacea, hunting terrestrial birds and breeding seabirds, and food production. Most Polynesian islands originally supported big flightless birds that had evolved in the absence of predators, New Zealand's moas and Hawaii's flightless geese being the best known examples. While those birds were important food sources for the initial colonists, especially on New Zealand's South Island, most of them were soon exterminated on all islands because they were easy to hunt down. Breeding seabirds were also quickly reduced in number, but continued to be important food sources on some islands. Marine resources were significant on most islands, but least so on Easter, Pitcairn, and the Marquesas, where people, as a result, were especially dependent on food that they themselves produced. Ancestral Polynesians brought with them three domesticated animals, the pig, chicken, and dog, and domesticated no other animals within Polynesia. Many islands retained all three of those species, but the more isolated Polynesian islands lacked one or more of them, either because livestock brought in canoes failed to survive the colonists' long overwater journey, or because livestock that died out could not be readily obtained again from the outside. For instance, isolated New Zealand ended up with only dogs, Easter and Tikopia with only chickens. Without access to coral reefs or productive shallow waters, and with their terrestrial birds quickly exterminated, Easter Islanders turned to constructing chicken houses for intensive poultry farming. At best, however, these three domesticated animal species provided only occasional meals. Polynesian food production depended mainly on agriculture, which was impossible at sub-Antarctic latitudes because all Polynesian crops were tropical ones, initially domesticated outside Polynesia and brought in by colonists. The settlers of the Chathams and the cold southern part of New Zealand's South Island were thus forced to abandon the farming legacy developed by their ancestors over the previous thousands of years and to become hunter-gatherers again. People on the remaining Polynesian islands did practice agriculture based on dryland crops, especially taro, yams, and sweet potatoes, irrigated crops, mainly taro, and tree crops such as breadfruit, bananas, and coconuts. The productivity and relative importance of those crop types varied considerably on different islands, depending on their environments. Human population densities were lowest on Henderson, Rennell, and the atolls because of their poor soil and limited fresh water. Densities were also low on temperate New Zealand, which was too cool for some Polynesian crops. Polynesians on these and some other islands practiced a non-intensive type of shifting-slash-and-burn agriculture. Other islands had rich soils, but were not high enough to have large permanent streams and hence irrigation. Inhabitants of those islands developed intensive dryland agriculture, requiring a heavy input of labor to build terraces, carry out mulching, rotate crops, reduce or eliminate fallow periods, and maintain tree plantations. Dryland agriculture became especially productive on Easter, Tiny Anuta, and Flat and Low Tonga, where Polynesians developed most of the land area to the growing of food. The most productive Polynesian agriculture was taro cultivation in irrigated fields. Among the more populous tropical islands, that option was ruled out for Tonga by its low elevation and hence its lack of rivers. Irrigation agriculture reached its peak on the westernmost Hawaiian islands of Kauai, Oahu, and Molokai, which were big and wet enough to support not only large permanent streams, but also large human populations available for construction projects. Hawaiian labor corvées built elaborate irrigation systems for taro fields, yielding up to 24 tons per acre, the highest crop yields in all of Polynesia. Those yields, in turn, supported intensive pig production. Hawaii was also unique within Polynesia in using mass labor for aquaculture by constructing large fish ponds in which milkfish and mullet were grown. As a result of all this environmentally related variation in subsistence, human population densities measured in people per square mile of arable land varied greatly over Polynesia. At the lower end were the hunter-gatherers of the Chathams, only 5 people per square mile, and of New Zealand's South Island and the farmers of the rest of New Zealand, 28 people per square mile. In contrast, many islands with intensive agriculture attained population densities exceeding 120 per square mile. Tonga, Samoa, and the Societies achieved 210 to 250 people per square mile, and Hawaii, 300. The upper extreme of 1,100 people per square mile was reached on the island of Anuta, whose population converted essentially all the land to intensive food production, thereby crammed 160 people into the island's 100 acres, and joined the ranks of the densest self-sufficient populations in the world. Anuta's population density exceeded that of modern Holland, and even rivaled that of Bangladesh. Population size is the product of population density, people per square mile, and area, square miles. The relevant area is not the area of an island, but that of a political unit, which could be either larger or smaller than a single island. On the one hand, islands near one another might become combined into a single political unit. On the other hand, single large rugged islands were divided into many independent political units. Hence, the area of the political unit varied not only with an island's area, but also with its fragmentation and isolation. For small, isolated islands without strong barriers to internal communication, the entire island constituted the political unit, as in the case of Anuta with its 160 people. Many larger islands never did become unified politically, whether because the population consisted of dispersed bands of only a few dozen hunter-gatherers each, the Chathams and New Zealand's southern South Island, or of farmers scattered over large distances, the rest of New Zealand, or of farmers living in dense populations but in rugged terrain, precluding political unification. For example, people in neighboring steep-sided valleys of the Marquesas communicated with each other mainly by sea. Each valley formed an independent political entity of a few thousand inhabitants, and most individual large Marquesan islands remained divided into many such entities. The terrains of the Tongan, Samoan, Society, and Hawaiian Islands did permit political unification within islands, yielding political units of 10,000 people or more, over 30,000 on the large Hawaiian Islands. The distances between islands of the Tongan archipelago, as well as the distances between Tonga and neighboring archipelagos, were sufficiently modest that a multi-island empire encompassing 40,000 people was eventually established. Thus, Polynesian political units ranged in size from a few dozen to 40,000 people. A political unit's population size interacted with its population density to influence Polynesian technology and economic, social, and political organization. In general, the larger the size and the higher the density, the more complex and specialized were the technology and organization, for reasons that we shall examine in detail in later chapters. Briefly, at high population densities, only a portion of the people came to be farmers, but they were mobilized to devote themselves to intensive food production, thereby yielding surpluses to feed non-producers. The non-producers mobilizing them included chiefs, priests, bureaucrats, and warriors. The biggest political units could assemble large labor forces to construct irrigation systems and fish ponds that intensified food production even further. These developments were especially apparent on Tonga, Samoa, and the Societies, all of which were fertile, densely populated, and moderately large by Polynesian standards. The trends reached their zenith on the Hawaiian archipelago, consisting of the largest tropical Polynesian islands, where high population densities and large land areas meant that very large labor forces were potentially available to individual chiefs. The variations among Polynesian societies associated with different population densities and sizes were as follows. Economies remained simplest on islands with low population densities, such as the hunter-gatherers of the Chathams. Low population numbers, small atolls, or both low densities and low numbers. In those societies, each household made what it needed. There was little or no economic specialization. Specialization increased on larger, more densely populated islands, reaching a peak on Samoa, the societies, and especially Tonga and Hawaii. The latter two islands supported hereditary part-time craft specialists, including canoe builders, navigators, stonemasons, bird catchers, and tattooers. Social complexity was similarly varied. Again, the Chathams and the Atolls had the simplest, most egalitarian societies. While those islands retained the original Polynesian tradition of having chiefs, their chiefs wore little or no visible signs of distinction, lived in ordinary huts like those of commoners, and grew or caught their food like everyone else. Social distinctions and chiefly powers increased on high-density islands with large political units being especially marked on Tonga and the societies. Social complexity again reached its peak in the Hawaiian archipelago, where people of chiefly descent were divided into 8 hierarchically ranked lineages. Members of those chiefly lineages did not intermarry with commoners, but only with each other, sometimes even with siblings or half-siblings. Commoners had to prostrate themselves before high-ranking chiefs. All the members of chiefly lineages, bureaucrats, and some craft specialists were freed from the work of food production. Political organization followed the same trends. On the Chathams and Atolls, the chiefs had few resources to command. Decisions were reached by general discussion, and land ownership rested with the community as a whole rather than with the chiefs. Larger, more densely populated political units concentrated more authority with the chiefs. Political complexity was greatest on Tonga and Hawaii, where the powers of hereditary chiefs approximated those of kings elsewhere in the world, and where land was controlled by the chiefs, not by the commoners. Using appointed bureaucrats as agents, chiefs requisitioned food from the commoners and also conscripted them to work on large construction projects whose form varied from island to island. Irrigation projects and fish ponds on Hawaii, dance and feast centers on the Marquesas, chiefs' tombs on Tonga, and temples on Hawaii, the societies, and Easter. At the time of Europeans' arrival in the 18th century, the Tongan chiefdom, or state, had already become an inter-archipelagal empire. Because the Tongan archipelago itself was geographically close-knit and included several large islands with unfragmented terrain, each island became unified under a single chief. Then the hereditary chiefs of the largest Tongan island, Tongatapu, united the whole archipelago, and eventually they conquered islands outside the archipelago up to 500 miles distant. They engaged in regular long-distance trade with Fiji and Samoa, established Tongan settlements in Fiji, and began to raid and conquer parts of Fiji. The conquest and administration of this maritime proto-empire were achieved by navies of large canoes, each holding up to 150 men. Like Tonga, Hawaii became a political entity encompassing several populous islands, but one confined to a single archipelago because of its extreme isolation. At the time of Hawaii's discovery by Europeans in 1778, political unification had already taken place within each Hawaiian island, and some political fusion between islands had begun. The 4 largest islands, Big Island, Hawaii in the narrow sense, Maui, Oahu, and Kauai, remained independent, controlling or jockeying with each other for control of the smaller islands, Lanai, Molokai, Kahoolawe, and Niihau. After the arrival of Europeans, the Big Island's King Kamehameha I rapidly proceeded with the consolidation of the largest islands by purchasing European guns and ships to invade and conquer first Maui and then Oahu. Kamehameha thereupon prepared invasions of the last independent Hawaiian island, Kauai, whose chief finally reached a negotiated settlement with him, completing the archipelago's unification. The remaining type of variation among Polynesian societies to be considered involves tools and other aspects of material culture. The differing availability of raw materials imposed an obvious constraint on material culture. At the one extreme was Henderson Island, an old coral reef raised above sea level and devoid of stone other than limestone. Its inhabitants were reduced to fabricating adzes out of giant clamshells. At the opposite extreme, the Maori on the mini-continent of New Zealand had access to a wide range of raw materials and became especially noted for their use of jade. Between those two extremes fell Polynesia's oceanic volcanic islands, which lacked granite, flint, and other continental rocks, but did at least have volcanic rocks, which Polynesians worked into ground or polished stone adzes used to clear land for farming. As for the types of artifacts made, the Chatham Islanders required little more than handheld clubs and sticks to kill seals, birds, and lobsters. Most other islanders produced a diverse array of fishhooks, adzes, jewelry, and other objects. On the atolls, as on the Chathams, those artifacts were small, relatively simple, and individually produced and owned, while architecture consisted of nothing more than simple huts. Large and densely populated islands supported craft specialists who produced a wide range of prestige goods for chiefs, such as the feather capes reserved for Hawaiian chiefs and made of tens of thousands of bird feathers. The largest products of Polynesia were the immense stone structures of a few islands, the famous giant statues of Easter Island, the tombs of Tongan chiefs, the ceremonial platforms of the Marquesas, and the temples of Hawaii and the societies. This monumental Polynesian architecture was obviously evolving in the same direction as the pyramids of Egypt, Mesopotamia, Mexico, and Peru. Naturally, Polynesia's structures are not on the scale of those pyramids, but that merely reflects the fact that Egyptian pharaohs could draw conscript labor from a much larger human population than could the chief of any Polynesian island. Even so, the Easter Islanders managed to erect 30-ton stone statues, no mean feat for an island with only 7,000 people, who had no other power resource than their own muscles. Thus, Polynesian island societies differed greatly in their economic specialization, social complexity, political organization, and material products, related to differences in population size and density, related in turn to differences in island area, fragmentation, and isolation and in opportunities for subsistence and for intensifying food production. All those differences among Polynesian societies developed within a relatively short time and modest fraction of the Earth's surface, as environmentally related variations on a single ancestral society. Those categories of cultural differences within Polynesia are essentially the same categories that emerged everywhere else in the world. Of course, the range of variation over the rest of the globe is much greater than that within Polynesia. While modern continental peoples included ones dependent on stone tools, as were Polynesians, South America also spawned societies expert in using precious metals, and Eurasians and Africans went on to utilize iron. Those developments were precluded in Polynesia, because no Polynesian island except New Zealand had significant metal deposits. Eurasia had full-fledged empires before Polynesia was even settled, and South America and Mesoamerica developed empires later, whereas Polynesia produced just two proto-empires, one of which, Hawaii, coalesced only after the arrival of Europeans. Eurasia and Mesoamerica developed indigenous writing, which failed to emerge in Polynesia, except perhaps on Easter Island, whose mysterious script may, however, have postdated the islanders' contact with Europeans. That is, Polynesia offers us a small slice, not the full spectrum, of the world's human social diversity. That shouldn't surprise us, since Polynesia provides only a small slice of the world's geographic diversity. In addition, since Polynesia was colonized so late in human history, even the oldest Polynesian societies had only 3,200 years in which to develop, as opposed to at least 13,000 years for societies on even the last colonized continents, the Americas. Given a few more millennia, perhaps Tonga and Hawaii would have reached the level of full-fledged empires battling each other for control of the Pacific. With indigenously developed writing to administer those empires, while New Zealand's Maori might have added copper and iron tools to their repertoire of jade and other materials. In short, Polynesia furnishes us with a convincing example of environmentally related diversification of human societies in operation. But we thereby learn only that it can happen because it happened in Polynesia. Did it also happen on the continents? If so, what were the environmental differences responsible for diversification on the continents, and what were their consequences? Chapter 3, Collision at Cajamarca. The biggest population shift of modern times has been the colonization of the New World by Europeans, and the resulting conquest, numerical reduction, or complete disappearance of most groups of Native Americans, American Indians. As I explained in Chapter 1, the New World was initially colonized around or before 11,000 BC by way of Alaska, the Bering Strait, and Siberia. Complex agricultural societies gradually arose in the Americas far to the south of that entry route, developing in complete isolation from the emerging complex societies of the Old World. After that initial colonization from Asia, the sole well-attested further contacts between the New World and Asia involved only hunter-gatherers living on opposite sides of the Bering Strait, plus an inferred trans-Pacific voyage that introduced the sweet potato from South America to Polynesia. As for contacts of New World peoples with Europe, the sole early ones involved the Norse, who occupied Greenland in very small numbers between AD 986 and about 1500. But those Norse visits had no discernible impact on Native American societies. Instead, for practical purposes, the collision of advanced Old World and New World societies began abruptly in AD 1492 with Christopher Columbus's discovery of Caribbean islands densely populated by Native Americans. The most dramatic moment in subsequent European-Native American relations was the first encounter between the Inca Emperor Atahualpa and the Spanish conquistador Francisco Pizarro at the Peruvian highland town of Cajamarca on November 16, 1532. Atahualpa was absolute monarch of the largest and most advanced state in the New World, while Pizarro represented the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, also known as King Charles I of Spain, monarch of the most powerful state in Europe. Pizarro, leading a ragtag group of 168 Spanish soldiers, was in unfamiliar terrain, ignorant of the local inhabitants, completely out of touch with the nearest Spaniards, 1,000 miles to the north in Panama, and far beyond the reach of timely reinforcements. Atahualpa was in the middle of his own empire of millions of subjects and immediately surrounded by his army of 80,000 soldiers, recently victorious in a war with other Indians. Nevertheless, Pizarro captured Atahualpa within a few minutes after the two leaders first set eyes on each other. Pizarro proceeded to hold his prisoner for 8 months, while extracting history's largest ransom in return for a promise to free him. After the ransom, enough gold to fill a room 22 feet long by 17 feet wide to a height of over 8 feet was delivered, Pizarro reneged on his promise and executed Atahualpa. Atahualpa's capture was decisive for the European conquest of the Inca Empire, although the Spaniards' superior weapons would have assured an ultimate Spanish victory in any case. The capture made the conquest quicker and infinitely easier. Atahualpa was revered by the Incas as a sun god, and exercised absolute authority over his subjects, who obeyed even the orders he issued from captivity. The months until his death gave Pizarro time to dispatch exploring parties unmolested to other parts of the Inca Empire, and to send for reinforcements from Panama. When fighting between Spaniards and Incas finally did commence after Atahualpa's execution, the Spanish forces were more formidable. Thus, Atahualpa's capture interests us specifically as marking the decisive moment in the greatest collision of modern history. But it is also of more general interest because the factors that resulted in Pizarro seizing Atahualpa were essentially the same ones that determined the outcome of many similar collisions between colonizers and native peoples elsewhere in the modern world. Hence, Atahualpa's capture offers us a broad window onto world history. What unfolded that day at Cajamarca is well known, because it was recorded in writing by many of the Spanish participants. To get a flavor of those events, let us relive them by weaving together excerpts from eyewitness accounts by six of Pizarro's companions, including his brothers Hernando and Pedro. The prudence, fortitude, military discipline, labors, perilous navigations, and battles of the Spaniards, vassals of the most invincible emperor of the Roman Catholic Empire, our natural king and lord, will cause joy to the faithful and terror to the infidels. For this reason, and for the glory of God our Lord, and for the service of the Catholic Imperial Majesty, it has seemed good to me to write this narrative and to send it to your Majesty, that all may have a knowledge of what is here related. It will be to the glory of God, because they have conquered and brought to our holy Catholic faith so vast a number of heathens, aided by his holy guidance. It will be to the honor of our emperor, because, by reason of his great power and good fortune, such events happened in his time. It will give joy to the faithful that such battles have been won,